Donald Trump drops more peace and trade deal bombs than Barack Obama did from a Predator drone. And we're going to be covering Murray. Douglas Murray continues his book tour with male feminist Jordan Beta Peterson. And welcome to Human Reaction, everybody. My name is David Rand, and my co-host here, Kyle Mack.
I had to think through that there for a second. I was like, wait, more than Barack Obama? Okay, I got it.
Yeah, I got that. I see where you're going. I kind of messed it up a little bit.
I see where you're going with it. Yeah, I get it.
It's funny. You read it, and then you're like, oh, I got it. And then you start, blah, blah, blah. And Joe and Bennett, they're out. We miss you, Bay. Mm-hmm. Miss you guys. And
cue the thing. If you want to support the show, make sure to like, comment, subscribe, leave us a comment. Let us know how you're feeling about all the things that are going on. There has been a lot of news. It's one of those things where it has not been boring here with the Trump administration in office. There's constantly new things happening every time. Let us know, what is the most interesting stuff that's been keeping, that's been on your mind with where everything's moving and all these political shifts right now?
Yeah, India, Pakistan, that was quick.
Yeah, that was very quick.
I didn't even get to research it. Everyone was like, what do you think about it? What do you think about it? I was like, I don't know. I don't know anything about this.
Much like J.D. Vance, and it was just like, what does it have to do with us?
Yeah, right.
But apparently J.D. and Marco both played a role in putting an end to it.
There we go.
Good, which is, I feel like, a good use of our executive branch. It's just been like, guys, just knock it off. Don't trade bombs. Trade goods. Yeah. Which is what Trump said in his Saudi speech. He said exactly that.
Trump Bastiat. Trump Bastiat. I love it. So he's also cutting trade deals. Let's get into it. China.
Yeah. So just being the trade deal guy on the podcast now, I guess I'll run a quick rundown on this. not a whole lot has occurred on there. It's more like a deal for a deal has started. The deal for the beginnings of the deal has started.
Yeah, but to create the conditions, they've lowered the tariffs, made a friendlier environment. Okay, we can work together. Now, they still have a 30% tariff on China, right? That's mostly
China has a 10% on us during this period. Which is
Take that. That's actually, wow. Generous of them. Mm-hmm. But the 30%, that's constituents of the fentanyl tariff, and then the reciprocal trade tariff, right? Is that
10 plus 20 makes 30, and it's based off of that. That's how they're that's how the math works out there.
Super scientific. I like
it. Yeah, the basics of it is Bessent was in Treasury Secretary Bessent, Bay.
Your Bay.
My Bay, apparently.
Yeah. I bet he's into that. You're a nice little twink for him. He'd be into that.
Dude's a big dude. We saw with Ho Duck Fuck, the Vietnam minister, right?
I just assume Ho was just a petite gentleman. But, okay, all right.
No, we see it every day. Bessent's in a new negotiator, which is interesting for the Treasury Secretary, is that he's become lead negotiator and all this stuff, where he's going around doing all the negotiation side. He's supposed to be just a glorified bond salesman, but he's doing more than that. And it's interesting.
And that is interesting.
He was in Switzerland at the same time that China diplomats were supposed to be in Switzerland. There was a bunch of stuff going on in Switzerland at the time. And they decided to have a sit down, and it led to rescinding of tariffs. Now, if you're listening to whatever your favorite influencer is, and this is where I'm frustrated on trade stuff all the time, it's like, Trump has backed down. He's ceding ground on tariffs.
Or Trump has cut a final trade deal with China. It's completed. Yes. Promises
it's
kept.
One or the other.
Literally they set up like, hey, let's talk some more. But in the meantime,
let's have a good relationship here in the meantime while we do it. I believe if no deal is made within the next 90 days, it's like America's tariffs on China are going to go back to 55% and China's on us is going to go to 35%. That's part of the deal.
But it was 100 something, right?
It was 140. We had 140 on them, and they had 115 on us or something
like
that.
Okay, so even if this fails, it's only going to be a modest bump, but we know it's going to crank up after that.
Yeah.
But regardless, stocks went bonkers.
Crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
Everything's crazy.
And then part of that's probably on the whole trade deal secured sort of impression.
It is a tariff. It's 100 and... 15% tariff reduction. So businesses were like, right. Oh my God, this is amazing, right?
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of the focus on this is that was kind of laid out here was where a lot of the negotiations are lying is removing China's export restrictions on rare earth minerals. And that's not just us. It's also to like our allies and things like that. They're just like anybody that's super in with the US, including the US themselves.
Israel. No, I'm just kidding. I can't help it. I can't. I was just, it's a joke. We'll be talking about later. It's on my mind.
Rare earth minerals. Yeah. We're just restricting trade. Uh-huh. China is removing various US defense and tech firms from their trade blacklist. China.
So we're going to have Facebook in China now?
Who knows what that actually means? Like,
Mark Zuckerberg's like, it paid off.
Yeah, he's like, it paid off.
Yeah.
He's like, started doing MMA, got a deal with China. China cooperation on fentanyl smuggling. So everything, all things fentanyl. Apparently, their like diplomat that worked with Besant was a big thing that he brought forward. Like, it's a big deal on their end too. It was like, yes, we will work with you on that. You know, how that goes, we'll see. And then just various other non-tariff countermeasures that China tends to employ, which that could mean a lot of things, but yeah. We've kind of laid out in
probably
previous podcasts.
Money. It's going to be probably money.
Yeah,
right?
Like maybe certain things with currency manipulation, probably things like who knows?
Intellectual property, stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff. We've laid that out in previous talks on the trade deals of like, these are all things that the Trump administration is looking at that other countries do. And so any of those are on the table, right? Uh-huh. So, good all around. Seems like the Trump plan is working. We'll see if it continues to work and if the negotiations work.
Yeah.
It seemed like China, their economy has been struggling and they were struggling before this. So, you know, I remember having all my Grok chats with Grok on this stuff. My Grok chats with Grok.
Yeah. I thought maybe you had a special name for Grok for a minute. It's like,
with my special friend. I remember Grok had put out the thought that it was like China will probably come to the table in 6 to 8 months because of the stress, because it'll mean really bad things for them in like 14 to 16 months. So I was looking at a much longer time frame and how I thought this was going to go, but it seems like things have progressed quite quickly. So yeah.
The question is that I've seen raised, and I think it's an interesting question, is this ulterior motive from the Trump administration? A lot of small businesses have been, you know, raising noises about like, we don't have inputs. We can't continue. We can't find alternative inputs that we can afford. And that's a major constituency of Donald Trump, of course. And when small businesses start to fail, that's like that first domino. What the end of that domino line looks like, it could be really bad for the president. So is this something like that? Is that fair? Like a fair criticism? Like Donald Trump needs this a lot too right now? He can't be waiting a lot longer?
I think he could have waited longer, which was kind of the point of this all.
Because his own speech had this thing about like containers like basically coming back empty or at least not even delivering the United States and therefore a major problem.
It's one of these things where, because I feel like the caricature of Trump on tariffs is that Trump just wants to put like 4,000% tariffs on everybody and that will solve all the world's problems and tariff, right? And you know, there's a part of me many years ago that thought that was Trump's position, essentially. It was like, that's because that's how everybody talked about it.
Well, it is the most beautiful word.
It is the most beautiful.
So he does oversell a little bit.
But the reason it's the most then continue the clip, is because it's a negotiation tactic. It's something that you can use
and the
to
revenue's
get what you
great.
Want, right?
Right, and the revenue's great, and it'll bring back jobs and a bunch of stuff that is not negotiation, that's like autarky type point of view.
Well, it's very specifically is that it's like putting different people into different buckets based off of our relations with them. So like making revenue on certain people, but then using it on negotiations to force better deals, which I think is what we saw with Keir Starmer in the UK. Like we've wound up in a better situation than we've been in decades with them in the aftermath of all this. So that's where it's like, oh, tariffs are more nuanced than that.
And
that's the where I've come down to.
It's obviously true that he has both maybe oversold tariffs and give people a bad impression about his actual views. There's also like the confusion signal noise sort of question we've talked about many times with
fog
that
of
guy,
war
with
and
Trump.
Stuff, like purposeful fog of war.
Exactly. So each one of those can lead to false impressions and therefore everything always feels like it's a conflict, right? Or it feels like it's not consistent. But if you're watching what he's doing and then you're watching what the people around him they're actually doing the policy are saying, maybe you're building a better picture.
Yeah.
And that's really, I think, the steel man of your case so far. Right. And I
feel the same way with the Israel thing, which we'll get into later, too, is because there's a lot of drama going down with where things are moving in the Middle East and kind of the relationship with Bibi and stuff like that. And I always felt like a lot of the people that are like, I support Trump because I thought we were going to go and do no new wars or whatever. And then he gets in and he just like bows to Bibi. And so it's like, he hasn't really bowed to Bibi that much. Like he's given some concessions here or there, but it seems like for the grander picture, there's more to it than that. Like it's more nuanced relationship.
Right? We'll get to that in a minute, but let's talk about Saudi Arabia and a new trade deal with Saudi Arabia. Now we don't really trade with Saudi Arabia, right? Like, most of their oil goes to
stuff.
So we sell them weapons. That's not trade. That's us selling them stuff. They have a trade deficit with us in that case. This isn't trade balance. This is they buy Lockheed Martin weapons and we get dollars, I assume.
Yeah.
And their oil goes to Europe. So what's the deal with this trade thing?
Well, okay. So on the deal making side of this, so Trump signed in a $600 billion Saudi investment into the country. So, and a lot of this is going on the tech side. A lot of this is tech side. But then he joked that MBS plans to increase Saudi investments to $1 trillion. Who knows? Just because he's such a good guy. Like, he's just such a good guy. So I don't
know. Like pressure on, like, God, that guy.
But you can tell they have a great relationship. Like, you can tell. And there's... like, I have a lot of thoughts on that relationship, actually.
Well, the handshake indicates that.
Yeah.
Sure.
He did handshakes to the YMCA. Actually, here, let me just jump to that right off rip.
Yeah, let's do it. All
right. Right off rip. We have, so he ended the speech. We're going to get into the details of the speech, but he ended the speech with the YMCA. And then you have MBS getting up to his seat, coming up and shaking his hand.
It's a long handshake.
What a crazy time to be alive as the YMCA is going on while some of the most like important geopolitical maneuvering is happening.
One of the gayest songs in English played in Saudi Arabia to the Saudi royal king.
Here's also it's just how ridiculous is the Saudi Arabians. They brought in a mobile McDonald's to the event for Trump. So you have right here is there's a McDonald's on wheels out there.
Where's the door? Oh, no, I can see it now. Okay. First I was like, what? Well, there's stairs going to nowhere.
Yeah, but it's just...
This
is the world that we live in right now. It's just...
Nice.
Everybody's having a good time.
Do you think it's a bacon cheeseburger, though? Oh. Can you acquire bacon?
I don't know. MBS is secularized a lot.
Yeah.
Like, women can drive now.
Really?
Yeah.
That was the best thing about Saudi Arabia.
I didn't say he's great at everything.
Just playing. It's all jokes. We're just kidding.
Well, that is actually the interesting thing about MBS is a lot of people's conceptions of what Saudi Arabia is kind of outdated because a lot has happened in Saudi Arabia in the last 8 years or so since MBS became crown prince. And that's like a very controversial thing because actually what King Salman did is he bypassed the old way of choosing new heir apparents and he went to his seventh son from his third wife all the way down the line to this guy who's like risen up and centralized a lot of power into MBS.
The royal family.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's the king and then he went to his son, right?
Right.
But he centralized power and bypassed all of these other kids and centralized the power into MBS, who is now secularizing Saudi Arabia a lot. Kind of like getting them in with the times, going into a much more technological route, going even beyond oil. They're making the a bunch of their other industries are becoming much more modernized and actually rising above oil in their industry, for total market cap.
Wow.
We're seeing that with like the entertainment field where we have like LIV Golf in there. And that was always a big drama. A lot of stuff in like the esports scene is rising up in Saudi Arabia. And that caused a lot of problems during the Biden administration. That was like a big no-no and people were getting canceled and shamed for it.
For
like video games in Saudi Arabia, like esports and stuff like that. Yeah.
But why?
Because
it was a thing,
if you were like a content creator, YouTuber, Twitch streamer, thing like that.
In Saudi Arabia.
And you were going, and Saudi Arabia was like paying people to come out to these events so that they could kickstart their like esports industry there.
Uh-huh.
In the same way that LIV Golf did. Like LIV Golf paid a bunch, like Bryson DeChambeau and all these people came from the PGA, and they got paid like tons and tons of money in order to kickstart. So, sort of like content creators moving to Facebook or YouTube or whatever. Like they get these content deals, right? People that would go to those things and take the paycheck were like, would get like mass canceled online and stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, like, so that was like blowback from Western, you know, tech.
Western media in general. Because Saudi Arabia is kind of getting more with the times in the under MBS. Like MBS is seen as this kind of like philosopher king almost, where he's like very well respected, and he's seen as this like very wise, but like even though young leader that's like changing everything there. So
I'd be with you if it wasn't for the old Yemen policy, but this is a happy episode. We're not going to talk about
that. Well, I mean, but like the Yemen stuff's been going on since long before MBS took over though too, right? Like,
but also,
and he's not even like taken over. Like he's still the crown prince.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah. But also it was kind of his war, at least according to Scott Horton and many others I've seen. Keep going.
So let's get into just like actually some of what Trump has said during the...
Actually, real quick, just so, because I don't think we covered it. What are the $600 billion Saudi investments? This is just like a broad commitment just to invest in American companies or invest in American companies building in Saudi Arabia? Like what do they mean by Saudi investments?
Some of it is they are Starlink. They're buying a bunch of stuff with Starlink, which is interesting. You actually see, like, if you see this clip right here, you have Elon.
Left is
right going to
freak the fuck
out. Elon was sitting
they're
right behind
so
MBS.
Pissed.
Like,
they're like, this is cronyism.
Elon was sitting right behind MBS at
the new
event,
oligarchs
at the speech.
That's what's going to be.
NVIDIA and AMD, they secured 5-year deals with Humane, which is the Saudi Arabian AI company. It's also noteworthy Sam Altman was also in attendance. I wonder what Elon and Sam are like.
Yeah, doing stuff with the Trump administration. That's got to be weird.
Yeah. There was a $142 billion weapons deal in advanced weaponry to Saudi.
That's par for the course. We do that all the time.
Yeah, we do that. That seems bigger than normal. Isn't it usually like 80 or something?
So that is a lot.
Everything's bigger.
It's Trump. Everything's better. I'm not sure I'm pumped on that, but okay. All right. So we're going to give them weapons, and they're going to do Saudi investments in tech.
A lot of the stuff is they're going to start using Starlink for maritime and aviation use. So the left is going to have a heyday with
with the cronyism of that. Yeah, very specifically. I can see the concern, right? Because if you're close to power and you're getting special corporate, you know, deals made for your company specifically with another foreign power because of the president's power, that is a problem.
We're creating new national champions, right? Like on the Mike Benz lens. Yeah. Like these are new national champions.
Yeah, but ideally, what I would like to see is rather than this, why not secure a free trade deal? Where they can do these investments due to market clearing prices and, you know, regular market operations. Not you're going to give us $600 billion to give to Tesla, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know what the exact breakdown of where all the $600 billion are going.
Oh, sure.
Like, I don't know the exact.
Yeah. But it's the structure of it. That's kind of what I'm criticizing. It's like, you're going to give us this, and we'll give you $142 billion and whatever. It's like, why didn't you secure a trade deal so we could send them all kinds of goods? You know, like, what's that about? You know, like, why do this kind of – this is the definition of a crony plan, right?
Yeah, but you also have to remember this is a kingdom that we're talking about with their own sovereign wealth and everything, right? Like that's you have to work kind of within their framework on things too.
Sure, right? In order to do this, but that's the question is whether or not you should do this, right? Or should we be funding the Saudi government?
Yeah.
And they're, you know, with crony trade deals.
Sure. I'm just like saying is like there is a current framework that is in place with how we always operate with Saudi Arabia. So it's like I almost feel like that's a little bit more wishful thinking than is
too much
the reality of where we are actually currently at in the world. And that's actually a piece of Trump's speech was that he actually said that he praised Saudi Arabia for how much they've advanced over the years and also said like, as you guys move into other aspects of the world, we want you to do it at your own pace. Like he specifically said that type of stuff,
that's
right?
That's good. Yeah.
And they applauded that. Like, right. So like, there's a lot of like, remember, these are not like Western values.
But also neither's China, in a sense. So anyways, let's get to, he had a really good speech.
lambasting the neocons.
Yeah. Really liked it. So let's get into it.
Yeah, and I'll actually say, like, I listened to the entire speech today. I recommend listening to the entire thing for the full context of everything. Like, this was one of the Trump speeches that, like, oftentimes with politician speeches, even with Trump and stuff like that, like, you can just get certain clips and you're fine. But, like, this is one that I would recommend actually watch the entire hour.
Nice.
On people. Here is kind of probably the heavy hitting moment that most people were looking at.
And it's crucial for the wider world to note this great transformation has not come from Western interventionalists or flying people in beautiful planes giving you lectures on how to live and how to govern your own affairs. No, the gleaming marvels of Riyadh and Abu Dhabi were not created by the so-called nation builders, neocons, or liberal nonprofits like those who spent trillions and trillions of dollars failing to develop Kabul, Baghdad, so many other cities. Instead, the birth of a modern Middle East has been brought by the people of the region themselves, the people that are right here, the people that have lived here all their lives, developing your own sovereign countries, pursuing your own unique visions and charting your own destinies in your own way. It's really incredible what you've done. In the end, the so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built, and the interventionists were intervening in complex societies that they did not even understand themselves. They told you how to do it, but they had no idea how to do it themselves. Peace, prosperity, and progress ultimately came not from a radical rejection of your heritage, but rather from embracing your national traditions and embracing that same heritage that you love so dearly.
100%. Amen, yep. Brother. Oh, I love it. I love it.
That was the primary theme. Yes. That was the primary theme of the whole speech.
And I like that. Like, it's like criticizing the past and all the interventions. I do wonder to what degree that this, like, cronyist approach, which is not the free trade approach, and that's a valid criticism, is, you know, geopolitical in nature too, right? Oh, yeah. Right. It has to do with the Abrahamic Accords and reinforcing those, and, you know, that makes sense. And additionally, that, I mean, obviously there's a huge imbalance between $600 billion and $142 billion, and what that means as far as they're getting, you know, their pound of flesh out of Saudi Arabia and their capital for American businesses. I understand that from the Trumpian lens. 100%.
I do want to get into the regional diplomatic stuff too after the next clip, because there is a lot of stuff when it comes to Iran that was talked about in this speech, when it comes to Gaza that was talked about in this speech, kind of some of the things that MBS has said in regards to Gaza as well. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of the things that MBS said was, I'll say that right now, is that he said that,
do the accent.
I'm not doing the accent.
I'm kidding. Okay.
MBS conditioned Saudi normalization with Israel on the progress of Palestinian statehood. Mm. So the dynamics there, which probably plays a big role in some of the shifts that we may be seeing here with Netanyahu and stuff like that, right?
Right.
Because it seems very clear, and in the speech itself, he seemed to... Trump is building a pretty good repertoire and has had pretty good repertoire with both MBS and Erdogan of Turkey, which those seem to be who Trump is angling for being like, these can be like the primary people of the Middle East here. Like, it kind of seems like they have better heads on their shoulders and they're like, cooler heads will prevail. And like, unlike these other like psychopaths that exist here, like, that seems
about,
to be
talking about Bibi with that.
Talking about psychopaths. Talking about Bibi and Iran both.
Yeah,
like, right.
Right.
That seems to be more so where the Trump angle is. Mm. And it's actually just kind of, I found this clip to be, I found this next clip here to be, let's say, cute.
Let's do it.
It just kind of showcases the relationship between him and MBS, I felt like.
Exactly 8 years ago this month, I stood in this very room and looked forward to a future in which the nations of this region would drive the forces of terrorism and extremism, drive them right out of existence, and take your place among the proudest, most prosperous, most successful nations anywhere in the world, as leaders of a modern and rising Middle East. So exciting, so exciting. Mohammed, do you sleep at night? How do you sleep? Huh? Just think it.
I try.
He's saying I try.
What a job. He tosses and turns like some of us. Tosses and turns all night. How do I make it even better all night? It's the ones that don't toss and turn. They're the ones that will never take you to the promised land, won't they? But you have done some job.
I find that to be a
that is
clip.
An interesting that is an interesting moment. Yeah, 100%. It kind of shows up.
I think that there is some like actual like wisdom in that. Is the people that don't toss and turn, they're never going to get you anywhere.
Right.
They're not like actively thinking about the stuff all the time and things like that, right? But yeah, so that's kind of the relationship with there with MBS, but also just kind of it showcases, I think, the partnership. Mm-hmm. As a whole. And now I want to get into another, probably the most important clip of this is him talking about Syria. There was some very big news and announcement that came out of this, and it got a standing ovation from the entire crowd.
It's a very good thing. So.
Likewise in Syria, which has seen so much misery and death, there is a new government that will hopefully succeed in stabilizing the country and keeping peace. That's what we want to see in Syria. They've had their share of travesty, war, killing, many years. That's why my administration has already taken the first steps toward restoring normal relations between the United States and Syria for the first time in more than a decade. And I'm very pleased to announce that Secretary Marco Rubio will be meeting with the new Syrian foreign minister in Turkey later this week. And very importantly, after discussing the situation in Syria with the Crown Prince, your Crown Prince.
Look at that golf club.
And also with President Erdogan of Turkey, who called me the other day and asked for a very similar thing. Among others and friends of mine, people that I have a lot of respect for in the Middle East, I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Sanctions being pulled off. And I like the quote there of in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me how the U.S. State Department will just completely bust up a country. And then, you know, the worst person possible comes in charge and we're like, we'll deal with you. Rather than like in other countries, we're like, never will we deal with you. You know what I mean? Like, it's so crazy.
It is funny because remember the current dude there that's taken over after Assad is the former ISIS commander. That's like,
former Al-Qaeda commander.
He grew up.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a head chopper anymore. That was in his youth. That's the guy we're talking about. Now, don't get me wrong.
In my 20s.
The sanction policy is totally sensible. Dealing with people we don't like is totally sensible. It's totally Trumpian and completely reasonable. The better option for the people of Syria is, of course, to get rid of these sanctions. So total props to the Trump administration on that call. That's a great call.
Well, and it's interesting because we have two, again, like the key players in helping make this happen in the aftermath of all this was Saudi Arabia and Turkey, right? Like Israel's the one that wanted total control over Syria region.
Well,
right?
And Turkey took a big chunk of land too.
Yeah,
right?
Turkey took a huge chunk of land.
Yeah.
Huge.
And was the primary funder of the fighters who ended up winning the war. Mm-hmm. So this is a Sunni Turkish play in Syria as much as it's U.S. State Department probably on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So.
And Bashar al-Assad chilling out in Russia, retired now.
Yeah.
He's in
Moscow.
Go
back to dentistry now.
It is funny how that works is all these leaders, because like there's a bunch of these. No, he was a dentist.
Yeah, that's right.
A dentist. All these leaders in the Middle East that kind of have failed regimes that got ousted. Most of them, you know, except for Gaddafi and, you know, people of that nature, most of them are just kind of like chilling out and like London or Miami or Moscow. Like they've retired.
Man, if you want to make some good internet view cash, if you can get to Russia and interview Assad,
that would be crazy.
That'd be a great interview.
Yeah, I feel like
I'd love to do that.
I feel like somebody like Tucker's got to do that.
Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Which that's what I think is probably going to wind up happening to Zelensky in Ukraine. Crane is he's going to wind up, he's retiring living off in Miami. Somewhere afterwards. Yeah. I think that's probably the outcome that happens there.
He's not going to go back to comedy, really?
I don't know if his comedy career. I mean,
hard to watch.
Maybe he gets a Netflix special. I don't know.
That sounds right. That fits. So Iran. You also bring up the Iran dealings, as well, right?
Yeah.
So that's another important step for, you know, balancing the Middle East. You got two of the Shia Sunnis. Now we got to get the Shia faction involved here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here is him talking about Iran.
Repeatedly, I am willing to end past conflicts and forge new partnerships for a better and more stable world, even if our differences may be very profound, which obviously they are in the case of Iran. I have never believed in having permanent enemies. I am different than a lot of people think. I don't like permanent enemies, but sometimes you need enemies to do the job, and you have to do it right. Enemies get you motivated. In fact, some of the closest friends of the United States of America are nations we fought wars against in generations past. Now they're our friends and our allies. I want to make a deal with Iran. If I can make a deal with Iran, I'll be very happy if we're going to make your region and the world a safer place. But if Iran's leadership rejects this olive branch and continues to attack their neighbors, then we will have no choice but to inflict massive maximum pressure, drive Iranian oil exports to zero, like I did before. If you know that, they were a virtually bankrupt country because of what I did. They had no money for terror. They had no money for Hamas or Hezbollah, and take all action required to stop the regime from ever having a nuclear weapon. Iran will never have a nuclear weapon.
It's the right audience to say that to.
I think I wanted to go a little bit further.
But with that said, Iran can have a much brighter future, but will never allow America and its allies to be threatened with terrorism or nuclear attack. The choice is theirs to make. We really want them to be a successful country. We want them to be a wonderful, safe, great country. But they cannot have a nuclear weapon. This is an offer that will not last forever. The time is right now for them to choose. Right now, we don't have a lot of time to wait. Things are happening at a very fast pace. They're happening right here. They're happening at a very fast pace. So they have to make their move right now, one way or the other. Make your move. As I said in my inaugural address, my greatest hope is to be a peacemaker and to be a unifier. I don't like war. We have the greatest military, by the way.
Stop there.
Yeah.
But it kind of, you kind of see the, this is the peace through strength tactics. I want there to be peace, but like I can bludgeon you here.
Right. And it's another typical example of like Israel skeptics are hearing, oh, you're doing the bidding of Israel there. And then like other people are like, oh, no, he's really wants peace.
I think it's the negotiation. Like I think he is very fearful of nuclear arms as a whole. And I think that is a piece of this, but there is kind of, in order for everybody to come to the table, most of these countries don't want Iran to have a nuclear arm, you know?
Right.
So like that is a piece that has to make it for a larger peace agreement across the Middle East, right?
It just returns to the question that I've had since the beginning which is what additional inspections are you going to be able to cut a deal with that weren't already in the JCPOA? You know, it really just pulling out of the Obama deal just has not seemed like it was just a mistake that he is just trying to make up for at this point, because I really wonder, right? The more you learn, the more you know about the Obama deal, the more you're like, I don't know what else you're going to be able to get past that. But we'll see.
I'll be curious with that too. I believe in something that people aren't talking about as much. I believe that there's like North Korea involvement in this as well too on the nuclear side. So I think that there's something going on there that I haven't fully looked into yet. I've seen people that I trust on geopolitical topics talk about the North Korea angle here.
Yeah.
I've never really seen anybody in like regular news space talk about that. So that's an area that I would be curious to get more understanding of, because that is the thing, is people are making it seem like, well, he pulled out of the Iran deal and now he just wants to make a new Iran deal. It's like, I think there's probably more nuance to that.
Well, there could be features of the Iran deal, like what your theory about France's role that could be real. I'm open to that, and maybe that's a real reason, but it was at the cost of the only inspection regime that we've really been able to build that really looked like it could actually normalize relations with Iran. But if anyone's going to do it, it has to be a Republican. The reason why is because Republicans, as usual, are the ones that have been most hawkish traditionally in Middle Eastern foreign policy, so it leaves less room for Democrats and Republicans to actually fight it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I have every ambition and hope that that's the way it'll go. It's just always, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm always like, but why did you fucking, you didn't have to do that, you know?
The dropping out of the JCPOA makes, I get that, but like, it's also one of those things where I think he thought he had another term in 2020 to 2024 right. to like, there's this strange thing about like the geopolitical world right now, which mm-hmm. is the, like, there's this gap in between the Trump plans that mm-hmm. seems to be, and In one ways, it's like a blessing in disguise, because I feel like Trump's will to power is even stronger than ever. And just like the people around him are better than they would have been otherwise, you know, like, so like, it's almost like good that that gap happened.
Right, in between.
But like, it is this thing where there's like, there was this 4-year disruption in what, the more I look back on term one, the more I see, and the more I'm understanding what's happening in term two, I'm like, oh, I see what he was doing. And I think I was like kind of naive to the understanding of what he was attempting to do at the time.
And we didn't know. Like, a lot of that stuff didn't become clear until the actual chickens come home to roost. And hopefully that's what we'll see with the Iran deal. We'll actually understand maybe why he pulled out when he actually cuts the deal by comparing the differences.
Yeah. There are other areas, like just some highlights of here, is he's talking, he was hyping up the, there's going to be meetings in Turkey for peace in Ukraine this Thursday. Mm. So he was kind of hyping up that. And also just some, like, I thought there were some interesting quotes in here that kind of highlighted Trump's foreign policy philosophy, in a sense. I'm kind of paraphrasing these. These are just things that stuck with me as I was thinking about it after I watched it. As president of the United States, my preference will always be peace and partnership. For too long, people have been using the United States as a weapon to dispense justice for the sins of one another. Mm. The other is, peace through strength means hopefully you never have to use your weapons. It seems like a waste of money, but hopefully we never have to because the destructive power of our weapons is like nobody's seen before. It's God's job to sit in judgment and my job to promote peace and prosperity.
I love it. Those are great words.
Yeah, those are great words.
We'll see how the actions follow through, brother. I'm in your corner. I hope it works.
Then the other stuff was the Houthi stuff, which he did talk about the Houthis in the speech as well. I just didn't pull the clips on those.
Yeah. Trump made, of course, to like back up a little bit, Trump did make a deal with the Houthis directly to stop bombing the Houthis. Now that pissed off all the right people. So Mark Levin, who wrote a great book called Liberty and Tyranny, which is was a really good back in the day for me. But unfortunately, arch neocon. He had a tweet, quote, "The Houthis are attacking Israel with missiles. As I post this, too bad we cut a deal with them that intentionally excluded our ally Israel. It gave them a green light. There should be no distance between us and our ally, especially when dealing with terrorists." But Mark, they're not us. But like, it's so dumb, right? I mean, it's like, they're mad, and Ben Shapiro is obviously mad at this too, that Ben we Shapiro went directly mad. To someone who was attacking our ships and say, knock it off. And they said, well, you got to get peace in the Palestine. Otherwise, then we're like, well, you know, that's Israel's thing. Just stop attacking us. And then they did. You know, we've already done Israel's work.
Got them to stop attacking Saudi Arabia as part of it too, which is also interesting. He mentions that in the speech, and is actually, they were bombing this exact city that they were in.
Right. So, well, that's when it actually cooled down before October 7th, was because the Houthis started to get access to weapons, probably from Iran, that were able to attack deeper into Saudi, that actually made them want to not prosecute the war anymore.
Other elements of the Mark Levin thing, and this just kind of shows where it just, they're flailing.
This is like, where the woke right is at.
The neocons are flailing right now. Mark Levin actually deleted this tweet, so I had to pull up an old image of it.
Perfect.
It was a quote tweet from Rapid Response 47, which is the neocon, which is a quote from Steve Witkoff. The neocon element believes that war is the only way to solve things, and the president believes that his force of personality, the way that he is going to respond to situations, can bend people to do things in a much better way. I believe in that too. That's what Steve Witkoff said. And Mark Levin said, by the way, neocon is a prerogative for Jew. Unbelievable.
Pejorative.
Or, no, prerogative.
Oh, he spelt it wrong.
Prerogative makes it even weirder.
That's way worse.
That's worse.
did he tweet it because it's obviously a shameful tactic to, you know, wave the race card around, or is it did he do it because he misspelled pejorative?
But like this is the same thing that Douglas Murray did with Dave Smith on the Rogan debate. Was like, it's right. Just like, how dare you use a guy with a neocon's like with a last name that sounds Jewish? You're going to spread anti-Semitism.
Yeah,
it's just like,
right.
I don't know. People have Jewish last names and they're part of big, like, important,
part of the government.
They're part of the government. Like, I feel like I should be allowed to talk about them. I don't know. Like, I don't care if it, like, oh, Wolf. Oh, scary.
Yeah. Well, especially because he looked at this and he was like, wait a minute, Witkoff might be a Jew.
Well, you know, like, and Steve Witkoff is Jewish. That's the other thing. Like, that's actually exactly, exactly. Is that he's also Jewish.
It's
so it's
so
like,
so,
but like they're all trying to, all of the neocons are just saying, one, it's kind of funny because back in February or January, like whenever Witkoff came on board and is to be like his right-hand man that can go where Trump can't go.
Right.
All these same people are like, oh, Witkoff's going to be great for Israel. Mm-hmm. And now it's like a few months later, they're just like, he's a terrible negotiator. He's awful. He's immature. He doesn't know what he's doing. And it's just like, it's like, you just can't deal with these people.
Well, and that's what Ben Shapiro did, right? He said that Steve Witkoff is a terrible negotiator right off the bat.
Yeah.
He did this whole video on that. And then also he has this bit about his foreign policy on Iran, what he thinks the U.S. should do with Iran.
Yeah.
So what exactly is Iran giving away that makes Steve Witkoff and company optimistic in any way? Again, this is just so Iran can delay. And if President Trump doesn't want to bomb Iran, which, again, he has set out as sort of binary, there's a third option here, by the way, which is that the United States maintains maximum pressure on Iran and then Israel goes and attacks the Iranian nuclear facilities. I think that is actually the most likely outcome here if I'm just gaming out the possibilities for the next several months. With all of that said, all of this ties into broader Middle Eastern negotiations that are happening over everything from the Abraham Accords to the release of hostages to the future of the Gaza Strip to what's happening in Iran. Now, all of this crosses paths, obviously, with President Trump's visit to the Middle East this week. The biggest story in terms of the media coming out this week is a story reported by...
Yeah, and then he's going to get into the Qatar stuff, which I want to deal with.
I don't feel bad. I don't feel bad that I look down as much as I do. I also feel bad that when I actually have to look down at my notes. But he's spent that entire time looking at his notes. Like, he didn't look at the camera.
Like, what did they tell me to say here?
Yeah, right. Thanks, BB, for the notes. Yeah.
I got you, BB.
Yeah, right. So he's making the case that the U.S. should put maximum pressure on Israel, on Iran, while Israel bombs nuclear facilities. Now, that's stupid. The reason why is because we now know Israel's plan was not just to bomb. It was to go in with ground troops to do something about these nuclear facilities that are so far underground that they can't bomb them. Right? And yeah. Using American military planes, fighting Iranian military planes and troops fighting troops in Iran. Like, there was a ground invasion component of that. What are we talking about here?
Well, and that's the thing is, like, on the air war side, that's my understanding is Iran is actually very capable in the anti-air defense department, like just because of the mountainous region and how they have their anti-air defenses laid out.
Right.
My understanding is that they're very, like very good at that. That's like the thing that they're really good at.
Well, I'm sure they've invested heavily.
Yeah.
We'd have to see if they're good at it, but that's the question. And then we don't have to play the clip because we're running low on time on this particular segment, but about the whole Qatari thing, right? Everyone's latching on to Qatar giving Trump an airplane. You got to explain that because you were telling me before and it's just too interesting. I mean, like, so Qatar offered Trump a new Air Force One and he accepted. That obviously means that he's no longer a Russian agent.
He's a Qatari agent.
Much
like Tucker Carlson is or Dave Smith is.
According to the neocons, right? It's always some foreign country that you're acting on behalf of.
Yeah. Well, because they're the biggest sponsor of terrorism in the Middle East, Dave.
What?
Yeah, that's
I thought
that's
Iran
what
was.
No.
You just told me that Iran was. And before that was Saudi Arabia.
It's Qatar.
Oh.
I'm telling you, David.
Wow.
It's Qatar.
It seems like it moves around a lot. top position is under contention.
You know, it's an amorphous blob that shapes and mutates. That's the thing. That's the thing about anti-Semitism, Dave, is it mutates often.
And being the number one terror sponsor in the world.
Well, yeah, because my understanding, and this is a thing like I'm actually – I didn't put a whole lot of attention to this going into this. So, sure. Like, forgive me, I might get some details wrong here. But my understanding is that there's delays going on in the new Air Force One that required them Trump to get a new plane in the meantime or something like that.
Okay.
Because like Air Force One requires so much to be put into it. And like literally takes like a decade to make it.
Huh.
Because the old Air Force One is like 40 years old.
Uh-huh.
Just extremely outdated. So Qatar offered like a really expensive plane for Trump to use temporarily, which then is going to go into it's going to be like an exhibit piece afterwards or something like that. It's something of that nature. I'm not clear on the details there, but so like there's this like temporary gift that isn't going to the United States for now, but it's going to be like a historical piece in the aftermath of it kind of thing.
Interesting. So obviously this means that he's an agent of Qatar because he's not dealing with him. And obviously the part of that is,
I do feel weird about like, just from a security standpoint, another government giving you a plane.
Also, the corruption thing, right? You shouldn't be able to accept a personal gift from another country and get more favorable.
It is like a gift to the White House. Like it's for presidential duties and use. But like, I worry about the security aspect of it.
Sure.
You know, just like a foreign government. Like, I feel like that's ripe for like spy stuff.
Yeah, right.
you know what I mean?
You gotta better have the NSA check that thing thoroughly afterwards.
That's actually more so what I'm concerned about.
Shut off mid-air. Did something that Qatar doesn't like.
That's the thing that's like more concerning to me than actually like the gift, because it is this like temporary gift in the meantime.
And right.
Unfortunately, whoever the next president is, like, they're gonna have to figure out the plane issue too, because the new Air Force One still isn't gonna be ready at that point. So
interesting. I think it will be
maybe Vance, that's a Boeing problem. I don't know why
driving like flying coach around as president.
Yeah,
that'd be a way to do it.
Yeah, with JD 2028, I ride coach.
And then lastly, and this has been a narrative that's been spinning out for a while, which is the Trump Netanyahu falling apart thing. And I just wonder, just kind of like sketch this stuff out, because it is a lot of dot connecting, but it seems to become more and more real as we are looking at developments across the Middle East. So the New York Times reported that Trump said no to the Iran offensive. Report on that. During April 2025 meeting, Trump announced the resumption of the nuclear talks with Iran while Netanyahu was present. And a lot of people speculated it caught him off guard. Right. Additionally to that, I mean, Israel isn't directing these talks. This is between the United States and Iran directly. Mm-hmm. Trump announced a ceasefire with Yemen's Houthi rebels in May 2025 without consulting Israel, which is really important. It shocked Israeli officials. The deal halted U.S. strikes on the Houthis to exchange for them stopping U.S. interests, attacks on U.S. interests. But it did not address Houthi attacks on Israel. So another piece of evidence right there, like connecting the dots. Next, Trump has pushed for a ceasefire in Gaza and proposed rebuilding the area into a, quote, Riviera of the Middle East. And remember that video that we saw where he was talking about that and, like, you know, BB's kind of has this really weird look on his face?
Yeah, that's right.
How much does that, you know, there's two ways you can interpret that, many different ways, but at least one of the ways is, like, if you think that BB's major thing is to do a final solution for the Palestinians— maybe that's not actually the thing that's going to do that, right? Mm-hmm. That could be that might be outside of his vision. Trump's decision to exclude Israel from his May 2025 tour, right? This tour that he's on now that he just gave the speech on didn't include Israel, right? It's in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. So
that is interesting.
It's an interesting signal, right? And then of course you had the Mike Walls situation where he was fired for basically leaking to Netanyahu Trump's plans. And, you know, there was some rumors that Trump was furious about that. And then he got fired, but he also got promoted in a different sense, you know, depending on your interpretation. Obviously, in the D.C. circle area, it was a fire.
Yeah, no, like, it's a corporate. We're moving you into a new location.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah,
that's what it is.
We're upsizing, downsizing.
That's how UN ambassador role kind of is.
And then lastly, news as of today, Macron, you know, the guy with
the tranny wife.
And other Western leaders are also criticizing Netanyahu today. So, interesting moment. We could see the world.
That's also interesting because France has such a big relationship with Israel in the past. They were a very key player in Israel making nuclear weapons, like their nuclear weapon program was a very like secretive program that France was helping fuel, kind of outside of U.S. purview at the time. That's at least my understanding of the history. So like, it's just, that is like a, there's like a diplomatic thing where it's like, oh, France is pulling back. That's like another interesting key. Like, why are all these leaders pulling back from Israel in this moment? Like,
all at the same time.
That's just very interesting to me.
When Trump is cutting deals with Saudi Arabia, when all these things are happening, it's an interesting set of events.
I feel like if you're like a boomer conservative who's like, Israel can do no wrong no matter what all the time, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're in that purview where you've been inundated with neocon commentators for decades. Like, I kind of wonder how you compart this in your reality with Trump right now.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's a...
Yeah, I think the tribal identity is so strong right now. Like, people are just going with it. They're like, I don't know, I trust him. You know, I think that's probably a lot of it for the Trump voter, for the base. And then, but all your influencers are freaking out. They're all going Mark Levin saying,
yeah, well,
you know,
it's like all those types of commentators, like Glenn Beck was crying. Like,
Glenn Beck was crying.
Yeah. It's like, it's just, you have all those types where they've just been so like inundating their audiences with like pro-Israel propaganda for so long. It's just like, if you're still listening to them and you're just kind of like, but I was a big Trump supporter and like, how are they doing? Like, how is he doing this? Like, you just must be there must be a cognitive dissonance there. That's like very, like, I'd be interested in picking apart that person's brain and trying to understanding the dissonance that's going on.
100%. You know who else is crying this week? Douglas Murray.
He's still on his crying tour.
Yeah, he's still crying. slash book tour.
I watched the clips you provided here, Dave. I could not listen to this podcast. I tried and I was
it was brutal.
It's awful.
Yeah.
Instead, I listened to the victory tour of Dave Smith on Tucker Carlson.
They were good. So from the perspective of this, like the big picture, overall, it was a book sale tour. They're getting into the different segments of the book. Mm-hmm. But it starts off with him talking about October 7th and why it happened and that sort of thing. And what Doug got as an investigative reporter, as a true hard-nosed shoe leather reporter on the ground.
Oh, he's been there.
He's been there. After all, so he must be giving us the straight of exactly why October 7th happened.
They even gave him his little press vest.
He got a vest.
Yeah, from the government of Israel. It's interesting.
And we say use their money, but the conception, which turned out to be a misconception, was that part of the security apparatus in Israel believed that leadership were happy with just being corrupt. They were living in luxury, you know, penthouses.
Corrupt was sufficient malevolence.
Corrupt was sufficient. Rather like the Soviet Union and by the 80s. You know, the leaders didn't believe it anymore. They just wanted to drink and have whatever they could in the time they had.
Right.
And
hedonistic materialism trumps fanatical malevolence.
And of course,
that's quite the theory.
Yeah. And many times in history, that has turned out to be true. A lot of revolutionary movements have done that. But this turned out to be completely wrong in the case of the Hamas leadership. They wanted to enrich themselves and they wanted to do what they said they were going to do, which was to annihilate the Jews.
All right. So the entire section of this podcast that they get into the dynamic as they frame everything leaves out. It's like, once again, history starts on October 7th. Nothing happened beforehand. In fact, they were living in perfect harmony and nothing was happening. Other than you had a corrupt leadership of Hamas.
Who just wanted to get rich and drink.
Yeah.
That's
right.
That's all they wanted to do.
I mean, that'd be the theory. And then, you know, and to give Douglas's props, I think that probably is a legitimate theory of the mistake of the intelligence and the overall strategy of like buying off Hamas by doing that. And that's of the international community. Maybe that was part of it. There is a lot of UN funds that go into there. And of course, as with all international aid, it is poor people in Western states giving money to rich people in poor states. That's how it works. But once again, it's this time horizon bias that just frames everything in terms of everything was fine. And then out of nowhere, for no reason at all, other than that they're anti-Semitic, Hamas attacked Israel.
History started on October 7th. That's when day one started.
Yeah.
And we're actually only in like 280 right now.
And what really bothers me is the way that they talk about the Hamas fighters as like cartoon villains. And there's a sense in which they are cartoon villains, right? Like we have like this cultural thing about terrorism. He just calls them terrorists, dude. He doesn't call them Hamas fighters. But I mean, yeah, I mean, did they inflict terror? Yeah. Did they try to inflict as much damage as they can on the civilian population in order to inflict terror and intimidate? Yes. But also, Hamas knew what was going to happen afterwards.
Yeah.
Right. The whole goal was to create a response in order for you to appeal to international, you know, pressure to get Israel to actually do something to change the fundamental conditions of the Palestinians.
There's problems. You got to do something to enact a response in order for any type of a change to occur.
Yeah.
And to catalyze something. And, you know, unfortunately, it was a very terrible catalyst, but that is
right.
But there's like, there is a history that leads up to that catalyst taking place.
Right.
Like, that's the important
and also thing. And also a very lack of set of options. Like, I don't know what exactly else they do other than capitulate. Like, all the questions they ask about, you know, what Israel should do later on are all also things that Hamas is also in a pickle about, right? Because yeah. they're in the situation where they have, they're pretty much a permanent refugee camp of being kicked out of one area of Israel that is now controlled by Israel and now living in the Gaza Strip. Most of the people who live in the Gaza Strip are not from there originally. They're from other places in Israel, and they were put here. Think about American ear reservations.
Yeah.
Right? That analogy exists for a reason, because that best explains in very shorthand
yeah,
terms
I feel like that,
what the conditions are.
I feel like the reservation idea, like, we're much further along in the process, you could maybe say, on America and, like, the Native American population, but just generations further,
well,
yeah,
in a
sense. But, yeah. like, but it's not exactly a concentration camp or, like, an internment camp like what we did with the Japanese, but it's, like, but it's not as simple as a reservation. Like, it's somewhere in between that.
Well,
like,
there's
a spectrum.
There are times in Western history where it was very similar to concentration camp.
Yeah. There were times for sure.
Right, so what they're at now is where we were at in 1890, yeah. right, in 1910, where the conditions on reservations were horrible, and the death rates were very high, and it was terrible for the people who lived there.
Well, it's also just like, I feel like most Americans don't really conceptualize that the Jewish people that conducted this plan, like the European Jews, like, they all came here and displaced a bunch of people that were there back in the 1940s, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that even really fully conceptualizes in people's heads that that's the events that occurred. That's kind of, okay, now decades and decades go by, near 80 years have gone by, and it's like, this is all the aftermath of that major catalyst. But it's like, 80 years have gone by, and we're now a few generations into this, and it's just like, oh, now it's like, now what do we do about it? Because you can't rewrite the past, and you can't, like...
And imagine this. Right? Imagine if instead of what the Native Americans is, which was largely integrate and kind of... Giving up isn't the right word, but trying to maintain their culture, not through combative means, but through peaceful means. They said, no, screw that. We will not give up, ever. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to do is we're going to have as many kids as we possibly can, and we're going to persist and maintain our people, our ethnic group, forever, mm-hmm. right? And we're going to do that by civil resistance, and that did happen. There are examples of civil resistance that were oppressed dramatically by the Israelis. Look up the Great March of Return. And then there's also examples of very violent, terrible terrorism, which has never worked out for them. But obviously, the civil resistance didn't work out either. So what the hell do you do, right, if you want to change the conditions?
Well, it's also just like you can, there's kind of an analogy here, too, of just like what the Israelis did here when it comes to, you know, all the conservative talking points about Muslim immigration into Europe that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And classifying that as an invasion, like... That's what Israel did to the people that were living here for hundreds and hundreds of years mm-hmm. under the Ottoman Empire, pre-World Wars, where everything got restructured in the Middle East. And then there's like a massive kind of violent immigration process that was happened that led to these moments.
But rather than being invited in by capricious, you know, progressive states, instead it is a project of much more powerful powers.
Yeah, like Rothschild
stuff, moving in, right? And they actually mock in this interview the idea that Israel was a colonial project, when it obviously was. Like, the whole goal was to...
And they wrote about it for decades ahead of time. Like, for it goes back into the 1800s where you can watch these, like, Zionist writings of them putting the project together. And it's like, a lot of it starts as kind of like think tank wonkery almost, where it's like, oh, this is the pie in the sky views. And then, like, eventually it turns into, like, this is the plan. We got the financiers. We got this stuff. We're going to create these immigration programs of, like, even if you're, like, a Jew in New York, you can, like, come in and get free immigration status here. Mm-hmm. Like, we can attract all, like, the Jews of the world that are displaced from the diaspora and bring them in. Like, you know, it's... in a lot of ways, it's actually very impressive that it was pulled off, 100%. Right? Like, it's crazy.
You know, but one of the things that's interesting, especially in this part before we go on to the next clip, is just how Jordan Peterson can put himself into the shoes of a school shooter or a mass killer, yes. but cannot stand for 1 second yeah. to ask himself, what is the motivation of a kid that joins Hamas? Like, why can't you do that? I just don't understand it. I have such respect for the guy in his ability to put himself in the darkest corners of the human soul, but these guys are just ideological. There's no other, they just hate Jews. There's nothing else to it. There's no story to tell there. Never mind that they live, that there are Palestinians who are Christians who live in Gaza.
Yeah, some like 8% of the population.
And they live alongside them, right? Not in perfect harmony, but they're not suicide, they're not genociding them either.
Well, and that's actually you actually made a really good point that struck me there. It was like, it was Jordan Peterson that told me to read Ordinary Men about the Nazi battalions in Nazi Germany and kind of understand and be able to like empathize of like what led them to the situations of wanting to do what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a very, and I feel like if you just took that logic of what you told all of your followers during your Genesis lecture series to, and placed it here, you would have a much better understanding of what's going on. And you could actually like, okay, I see both sides.
Yeah.
And like, that's
you actually, would be Daryl Cooper yeah, is what you would be if you implemented his own freaking thing.
Which is exactly what Daryl Cooper does yes. in his Fear and Loathing
yes.
In the New Jerusalem is yes. like, he tries to get it. It's like, okay, you can understand the perspectives of both sides and also understand this is a really hard situation to deal with because like both sides kind of have good points too,
yeah.
where it's
yeah,
like, yeah. you can empathize with both sides and understand it. And like, that's where I feel like being an adult
yeah, right.
should bring you to of like, okay, I understand this side's point of view. I understand this point of view, but if it's just like, no, they're just terrible people. They're awful. They're terrible. They just hate the Jews. Like, it's right. like, you're being childish. Like,
yeah.
that's just like a childish way of viewing actual conflict. Right. It's like if, you're a parent and you're looking at your kid and like, that's the type of attitude that they're having with a kid they're fighting with at school.
Yes.
Like, you would have yeah. to have them, you'd sit down with them and like have a conversation about this of like,
right.
no, it's more complicated than that. Like,
yeah.
let's help you work through these feelings. Let's, you know, it's
like, yes, 100%.
But like,
keep that in mind for your parenting series, Jordan, you know,
yes.
yeah. All right. So on Iran.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, whoops. Sorry. I muted.
So, for instance, they know that if you kidnap Israelis, mm-hmm. one of the absolutely central things of the fabric of Israeli society, as with most Western societies, is you don't allow your citizens to remain behind, just like you don't leave your soldiers behind. That if you fall behind enemy lines, if you are taken behind enemy lines, the state will do everything it can to get you back. And that has been a compact in Israel since the foundation in 48 and a really central thing. So
then why are we bombing them? Right. One of the biggest fears that the families of the hostages, who are one of the biggest critics of Bibi Netanyahu, is the leveling campaign. Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's not going to get the hostages back. In fact, it's probably one of the biggest dangers to the hostages' safety because the Hamas has no incentive at all to abuse the hostages, much less to harm them or kill them, because then they're no longer cards to play in negotiations. In fact, there are stories of hostages talking about their guardsmen basically not being able to eat while they fed them. Why? Not because they're angels, but because they're the currency that they will use to try to negotiate a peace to put pressure on for these two-state solution that they want. And second to that, you should bring out the Wiki article here.
Yep.
The Hannibal Directive. I mean, come on. Like, do you not know about it, Jordan? Like, you're not going to ask a question? Like, but what is the Hannibal Directive? Now, this is, you know, something that sounds conspiratorial, but this is a actual policy of the Israeli government that says if you're danger close or if you can be removed to take away their leverage, the Israeli government has the right to kill you to keep you from being a hostage of a terrorist. So, I mean, like, is that what you're talking about, Murray? Or are you doing propaganda? Because that's what it feels like, right? The existing policy makes no sense. We don't know if the Hannibal Directive was evoked. There are some examples on October 7th when it might have been evoked. I don't know. And then, but we don't know. We don't know. If it is evoked, it's going to be secret. They're not going to, like, blast that on Twitter.
Yeah.
Duh. And... you know, this bombing campaign is completely congruent with this directive.
Well, that's actually a funny, like the keeping policies secret about certain things. Like, I know I was listening to on Piers Morgan, he had basically a bunch of spies on, which was very interesting. He had like John Kiriakou and who's like former whistleblower at the CIA, but he had like the former lead of Mossad on there too. And that was something that the former head of Mossad said, is that we have a very strict, ambiguous policy perspective of, we do not talk about what our policies are on things.
Right.
Some of that was about like the nuclear deal, but some of that is just like Mossad operations of like, is like, we just don't ask, don't tell. Like,
right.
That's essentially what it is.
And right? If this was the central piece of their culture, then why in the ceasefire? Phase two was meant to bring out more hostages in exchange. So what? You know what I mean? Like, why start to starve that population if what your major thing is, what I'm going after here isn't trying to say, therefore, Israel bad. What I'm trying to say is, therefore, Douglas Murray is not doing press. He is not covering this. He is doing apologia, right? He is just explaining the perspective of the Israeli government. And that is ridiculous, right? To be just nodded through and not challenged at all.
Well, that's the problem that I have with the whole, like, have you never been thing is, well, he clearly, like, he went in, got an award from Israel, like from the government for his journalism. It's like, and then went through the whole IDF tour. And it's just like, yeah, okay, your journalism is just like, you took one side of this thing. You got rewarded for it, got like all these accolades for it, got a bunch of money for it. And you're just going to tell the narrative of a government, like, that's all you're doing.
Yeah. Right? Once again, that's not journalism, yeah. Right? Journalism.
That's like CNN and like the stuff. That's like the criticisms of the mainstream press.
Yes,
of like
exactly.
It's like all they've become is just the like the mouthpieces of, they're just being fed information from like CIA people or like from the intelligence agencies. Is like, yes, these are your inside scoop. It's just getting fed what you're wanted to be fed.
Yes.
For the sake of the international, you know,
and propaganda. It's the best example of a court intellectual. Your job is to justify the power of the powerful. It's not to hold them to account, which is what journalism is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next clip we had here queued up is him giving the like kind of the typical neocon argument here. So yeah. I'll let you bat this down, David, but here it is.
Enormously advantageous aspect of narcissism to this mix, because the narcissistic thing that Saeed helped to give American and other Western students was, nothing in the world happens unless you in the West make it happen. You make it so. The Palestinians, like all the Arabs, the Muslim world, the developing world as a whole, does nothing of its own volition. It can't even make mistakes on its own dime. It's you that made them do it. What did we in America do to cause this? Is the lens, the only lens through which an American student will be taught to look at the world. Why is this happening in China? What did we do to China will be the way. But everything is interpreted. So this is just not fit for purpose for understanding the world, but it's hugely narcissistic because, among other things, I mean, and you can see this in the spilling out of protests across America and other Western campuses.
I feel like Jordan Peterson's trying to like...
One of the things I say at one point in the book is, what level of delusion and narcissistic delusion do you have to be in to think that you at the University of Columbia or Berkeley or Yale or Princeton or Oxford can dictate war policy two continents away?
All right. So to start off, nothing is actually America's fault. Nothing is actually impacted by America kind of thing he's addressing. Just intuitively, just think about it intuitively to start. America is the global hegemon. Perhaps we had something to do with many things going on in the world. Just start there. Like, that's just a starting point. But then you go a little bit further. Mm-hmm. So the West, specifically Great Britain, took full control over the Middle East and designed the shapes of the countries.
They joked about it in the meeting. It's like, was it Churchill that said it? It was like, I think it was Churchill that said it, where he's just like, yeah, I just create a country with the stroke of a pen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the shape of Iraq was meant to, in order to keep them from being able to export their own oil to the ocean.
Well, and a lot
right?
of the,
that's why that happened. The division between Iraq and Kurdistan and Syria is there to keep three separate, competing powers with dictators on top in order to keep the Ottoman Empire from ever challenging the West again.
Well, and that's actually a really important thing too, because like we always talk about, like the Kurds always get brought up every time Syria was mentioned.
Our great allies,
our great allies, the Kurds. We do a lot of business with them, but it's like they are, there's a rabbit hole to go down there.
Yeah.
But like it is one of those things where in the Ottoman Empire, these were split up into different provinces, like different regions. So it was like, okay,
by ethnicity.
You have the Assyrians, you have the Kurds, you have the Iraqis, you have them all kind of split up where they kind of have their own say in their own local governments for the moving into the Ottoman Empire, like in a federal structure, kind of in a sense, not exactly, but it's like that. I mean, it's the same thing with in between Afghanistan and Pakistan, you had Pashtuns there, which these people are in these very problematic scenarios where they're split up into different countries that are drawn in a certain way on a map, but they're split apart because of the diplomacy actions. Yeah.
And
there,
not
right?
because they're dumb, but in order to diversify their power, disperse their power so they can't challenge you. So maybe, just maybe,
it's gerrymandering.
It's gerrymandering. You gerrymander countries, and then you're like, well, we have nothing to do with everything that happened after that. Now I'm going to get... Okay.
So, actually, your country, Douglas, did this.
Yes, yeah. Well, with our help. Yeah, our entry to World War I guaranteed that outcome, right? It could have just been a peace deal, and Ottoman Empire couldn't have persisted. We wouldn't have radical Islam. It was a response to World War I in which Milestones was written. Milestones is what started the Salafist movement. That itself carries on into the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda. All of those groups all come out of that one tradition. There's a couple other inputs, but that's the main line.
And there's like decades of generations and that turn into something.
It's a response to UK colonialism. And they just dismiss all that. And they just say, like, look, there's no causes there. When the shape of your country is determined by another power, maybe that might cause a little resentment. You know, there's just got to be something. I mean, I'm not saying it's everything. I'm not trying to remove their agency. I'm just saying maybe it has something to do it. Look at the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. Well, we funded one side of that forever and then turn around and overthrew that guy, Saddam Hussein, right? Why did we do that? Because the shape of the country was the shape of the country, right? And these should have been one country. It's all Sunni or it's all Shia right there, but we put a Sunni in charge of the other one and then we lost control of Iran. You know,
I remember back in 2014-ish era, 2015, I remember, was it Vox that did a documentary? They went and interviewed a bunch of like ISIS guys. This is back when like ISIS was like first becoming like a big deal that we were supposed to really care about.
Yeah.
And I very specifically remember the video footage of him being like, you see that line right there, like through that valley?
Middle of the desert.
No, he's like, that's the line of Sykes-Picot. Yeah. We don't abide by that line.
Yeah, and that's literally what happens. They made a country right on the border between Iraq and Syria because that's what I mean, so like, and this is like a Western value that you're supposedly the champion of, Jordan Peterson, that people can self-determine their destiny as a group, as an ethnicity, as a community. So us doing that is obviously an act of terrible tyranny. And yet you're just like, yeah. None of these are these guys. This is just them avoiding fault.
That's actually the thing that I appreciated. And this goes back to the Trump Saudi speech,
right?
Was this was a big theme. And it seems to be a big theme in general of his foreign policy of like, and Bessin said it too. Like he said, we're America first. We're not America alone. Like we want to have good partnerships. But like, that was a big piece of Trump is like, you guys have to get yourselves out of your own predicaments. You have to he's not using these words exactly, but this is the theme.
Sure.
So you guys have to like self-determine for yourselves. And we want to be good trade partners. We want to do all this stuff, but like, you also have to, you have to think like Saudi Arabia first. You have to think,
right.
Like you have to think about your countries and we're going to think about our countries and then we'll be partners.
Yeah.
Which
is a much more appropriate.
That seems to be the Trumpian philosophy.
And much more adult approach to the world, as opposed to what we've done in the Middle East for 100 years. We've been pulling off 9/11 after 9/11 for 100 years.
Yeah.
Millions of people died in the Middle East from American engagements. Everything from the Iran-Iraq war to the Kuwait war, Desert Storm 1, to what we did in the 1990s, 500,000 people dead, mostly children, from our blockade of Iraq. We are constantly intervening in the space. Maybe, Douglas, maybe that has to do with something happening. Maybe all of that billions of dollars spent has something to do with something, right? And then lastly, like really think about this. You have to take this argument. His argument is that you have North America's number one economy in the world, largest military in the world, incredibly manned, incredibly massively impactful, $800 billion defense budget, a license to kill for the intelligence apparatus to operate every country in the globe for 100 years, global dominance of the Treasury Department, of the International Monetary Fund, a tool of the State Department. And then you have to say all of that, and it has no matter of actions on world events. Any development must result from local decisions on the ground, ignoring what we do on the ground everywhere, when we are on the ground everywhere. When you look back, if you know anything about foreign policy and what we've done in the Middle East over this time period, you can't come to the conclusion that, oh, we had nothing to do with it because we've been doing stuff in there.
Yeah. One area, maybe it's a steel man of Douglas here, is that there is DNA in what he's saying, with a critique that I often have with people on, like, quote unquote, my own side oftentimes, is I often do feel like a lot of people that are, like, ideologically based on this issue or that issue,
sure,
they often do kind of this thing where they ignore other countries or other actors doing things, and they only focus on America. And like what I think Douglas is taking that and going too far, where it's just like America and Britain, they didn't do anything wrong, right? Yeah. But it's like, obviously America and Britain and all these countries, like, they had their hands in these things, right? But there is also the argument of, like, where I would give a little credence, or like maybe somewhat agree with what he's saying, is other actors are also doing things.
Well, sure, right? Look at Iranian relations with the United States. And if you don't start with Mossadegh,
yeah,
you're not starting the story. You're like,
exactly,
you're not doing the thing.
That's where I'm not, like, I'm not going to give him, like there's like a DNA of an argument that I sometimes, like, have a critique of my own people.
Sure.
But I think he's being kind of ridiculous because he's using this as justification for not going far back and looking at the
There's
context.
A low rent meme layer of the radical leftist that just says white, bad, brown good, or historically colonial bad, you know, local indigenous.
They have certain
good
heuristics that are leading them, and it shallows them.
Sure,
oftentimes,
but that's not.
Right?
Like, but that's also to ignore almost all the facts and just be like, okay, there's, of course, there are people on the ground that have lots of power and implement various different policies. We're not talking about that right now. We're not talking about Iraq's 1960s policy on gay rights and whether or not we had an impact on. What we're talking about is we gave them money to then go to war against Iran. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is, why did we do that? Well, because we overthrew the Shah, the Mossadegh, and re-emplaced the Shah. When we're talking about Iranian relations right now, it is determined by that. Because guess what? Just the same way that we're pissed off to this day about the British controlling our country, and we celebrate on the 4th of July, that's how Iran sees us. Mm-hmm. Right. Imagine if the UK came back and overthrew George Washington and installed the king again. And then we had to do another revolution. Right.
I agree.
Pissed off about that? I mean, come on. You know, that's what bothers me about it.
That's the thing that bothers me about Jordan Peterson, particularly in this, because he has all the tools and trained people with all the tools to be able to see this. Back in like 2016, he gave everybody, like, all of his followers, the tools to be able to decipher this whole endeavor because of that, and be able to have the empathy towards all sides and be able to have a clearer vision of things. And that's where I find it very frustrating with what Jordan Peterson has become, where he's just like, makes sense.
Uh-huh.
Makes sense. 100%. Totally makes sense. Like with no zero pushback here.
Exactly. Right? And another side of it, Murray, talk about the students. What are you going to do to affect these policies? Well, we're funding it, dude. We're giving them billions of dollars. Number one. Number two, all of these protest movements on campus, as far as I know, from what I've seen so far, so correct me if I'm wrong, drop me a link, is that they're all asking for a divestment. They're asking for the university to not fund Israel, to not deal with Israeli business partners in order to put political pressure on them. And that is their free right as Americans. The exact right that Congress was just about to pass a bill that would make that a felony.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not to mention, he's like, it's not going to have any effect. The Secretary of State is targeting 20-year-old students for deportation for writing an op-ed about it. So maybe it has something to do with something, Murray. I mean, it's any amount of challenge would be warranted in this space because it's just not engaged with anything happening.
Well, that's the thing about that, too, is just like the divestment, like the BDS stuff. You know, there's there's the aspect that always, this is the thing that annoys me about it. It's just like, it's a very special privilege to a very special group. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets kind of sticky. Like if it was like, okay, people wanted to organize a protest against this or that country, like people would be like, oh yeah, it's freedom of speech. There's no problem with that. But like specifically when it's Israel, all of a sudden it's like, we need a law to protect against this.
Exactly.
Like that's the thing that's always like, okay, what's going on
there? Yeah, right. You know, like, right. It begs the question, yeah. Why that? Right? We're not doing that for Ukraine.
But I forgot, just asking questions is an anti-Semitic thing to do. And then everything gets shut down for you just being like, that's a curious dynamic there.
Yes. Right? So I do want to get into being anti-war is not a moral stance. Let's skip over to that one, Kyle, because we're running out of time here.
Yeah. Too much
juicy trade stuff going on.
The Saudi thing was a very like
it's big deal.
It's a very historical moment. I felt
this
like
is
it
the,
just has a
this
speech.
Is the hardest part about running a podcast is making just editorial decisions because there's so much juiciness here that I want to get into.
But yeah, and we still want to. We're waiting for Joe to get back so we can do all the Maha drama.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like his wheelhouse, but he's been gone. So,
all right, let's do it.
And I've been asked many times in the last year and a half, why are the Israelis so bad at communicating?
I just got to pause right here. What is he doing? Like visually here, you see his like weird eye movement. It's just,
what?
I don't, maybe it's the chair that Jordan has him sitting in or something, but like he's doing this like weird.
He does lean forward and lean back a bunch.
Yeah,
in
but
the
then he does this like.
Yeah. Really?
Weird, like googly.
I'll watch
thing.
It again. I'll watch for it.
Many times in the last year and a half, why are the Israelis so bad at communicating? The truth is, it's extremely hard to communicate what you're doing to a world which, in significant part, has already decided that you're the bad guy.
And one that's manipulated as well, very profoundly, by the actors behind the scenes. And all the things that we talked about play into this. The refusal of the West to admit to the existence of malevolence, our inability to understand the difference between a just and an unjust war, our willingness to hide in the shibboleth that war is bad, which is hardly a moral claim at all.
No. I mean, I would say that people, there's a saying, I quote somebody saying the book is sort of idiot, British student survey. In which a large number of people said they wouldn't be willing to fight for their country, even if it was under existential threat. And
well, they've been taught that.
Yes. And when you dig down on the reasons why they said they wouldn't even be willing to fight for their country under existential threat, as the young men and women of Israel have had to do for the last 18 months, the most common reply among young British people of the same age was, war doesn't solve anything.
Right. War, yeah. Yeah, well, and you think about how easy it is to make the moral claim, for example. I've heard many people make this claim. I'm against the death of women and children. As if that's some sort of moral claim.
Well, once
as if that's not the basis of common humanity. No one can capitalize on that.
Yes.
On that what? On that profession of their morality.
Well, it's...
Yeah. Okay, so... America didn't think Israel's the bad guy, especially the press, especially the mainstream, right? It is not covered as the bad guy traditionally in America.
No, it's been like deified as a position that they're always good no matter what.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's being challenged.
What he's talking about is Al Jazeera, right? Or he might even talk about MSNBC, but even then they play all this stuff with kids' gloves because they're afraid, right? I mean, the American public has shifted because of social media, Douglas, not because the press is telling them otherwise.
That's
Israel,
why we need standards on Joe Rogan.
Israel is doing their communications work. Of course, that's what you're doing, right? And American people are not buying it. That's why we've seen this massive shift away from support for the war, right? Because they're watching kids get blown up every day. Mm-hmm. Just wake up, dude. Like and then
I'm in Telegram channels where I'm watching like the destruction all the time.
The IDF runs a Telegram channel. And we were talking about Jordan's like, oh well, it's just such an easy and convenient moral position to be against slaughtering innocent women and children. The IDF runs a Telegram channel with thousands of people in it where they celebrate the killing of videos. Yeah, well, it's thousands. Like it's almost 6,000, something like that. People in it where they post videos about the destruction of Gaza and celebrate it. Mm-hmm. So who's the monster here, right? We got a sitting member of Congress who is posting how great it is to have children be blown up and like, oh, great pick, send me more.
Here, let me pull that.
Oh, you still have it? Just forgot the guy's name right now.
Yeah, Congressman
Randy Fine. Yeah, elected out of Florida.
Visibility limited. Gaza must be destroyed.
Yeah, people live there, buddy.
There is no suffering adequate for those for these animals. May the streets of Gaza overflow with blood.
That includes kids' blood.
Yeah, well, here's an image of kid being in rubble.
Yeah, where he says,
all, no mercy. Yeah,
don't go back to it. But what he says to that image of that dead kid is, great pick, send me more.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you see a lot of these influencers on the on Twitter too that have kind of just really popped up out of nowhere. It feels like that they're making certain statements. There's one in mind. I'm not going to mention him, but he made this big like the justification for killing children in Gaza like post, mm-hmm. And you're just like, geez, dude, you're doing all these. Like logical leaps in order to justify it's one of these things where it's like there are going to be terrible casualties that happen in war and in some sense to steel man Jordan here is like it is a very easy thing to virtue signal, I would say, of being like, I'm against killing women and children. Like, I think that's kind of what he's getting at there. Like that is a thing to kind of like virtue signal, but there's also this dynamic of like, there is this like cheering on that goes on with the like, oh yeah, we killed another one and it doesn't matter. And like, there's like a glorification. It doesn't matter how many casualties there are. Like, there is a sense where I feel like you should be trying to limit as many casualties if you're conducting a war as possible. Like there's people who's that's their jobs. Yeah. is to run PSYOPs to be able to limit casualties.
They spend all this time about talking about how great they are about limiting casualties as they murder tens of thousands of women and children. And then maybe people go like, I don't believe you. Yeah. I think you're lying to me.
That's kind of what it feels
like.
You're
kind of one of those experts that have been lying to me. It feels a lot like that.
I feel like Black Ops types of spy type of stuff would be a much better approach to this specific scenario than just carpet bombing an entire region, right? Like that's what it feels like to
right
me.
But the problem is that they don't want to have any casualties themselves, so they're just they've devalued, and the amount of Israeli officials that have said completely dehumanizing things about the people of Gaza, not Hamas, the people of Gaza, calling them animals, calling them subhuman, calling them all these things is real. And if you're not aware of that, then you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. You don't care about them either. And that's the thing that really bothers me here, because actually being anti-war is the moral position, Jordan Peterson. It isn't. I mean, the guy got into his whole question of philosophy is, we were on the precipice of nuclear war.
So true.
And you were like, oh my God, are these people psychopaths? You know, and then you got into it. You got into the structure of ideology and how people come to their beliefs and all that stuff. It's all your
Jordan has an entire room in his house dedicated to Soviet art and stuff like that because of how fascinated he was with studying the atrocities of war in the Soviet era and things like that.
And now what you've become is the most radical, you know, Cold Warrior position, where you're like, this is just a battle between good and evil. There's no in between here. There's no other way to see the world.
There's no room for understanding.
It's only the terrorists versus the good Jews. That's it. And that's not how it works, because these are all people on the Jewish side too, where there are good people and bad people, people who have given their souls up to a demon of destruction, doing terrible things to women and children, to prisoners, to captives, to all kinds of stuff that you are endorsing by saying this is only a good side and a bad side. And then there are people who are just innocent Palestinians who don't want any of this, mm-hmm. who are too young to have voted for Hamas back in the day, who would love to have an alternative, but they're getting bombed.
Yeah.
Right. And you're not giving any other chance for that. And then like you're over here saying, well, it's just banal virtue signaling to say you're anti-war. Actually, killing women and children is wrong. And some people have lost sight of that. You know, because you got Randy Fine here saying, kill them all. That includes the women and children. And so I oppose Randy Fine. Does that mean I'm virtue signaling? What are we talking about here?
Well, and that's actually the thing, too, is because, like, oftentimes you get inundated with, like, nobody on the Israeli side is calling for genocide. And then you're like, I don't know. I exist on Twitter.
Yeah.
I see congressmen. That seems like a call for genocide. I don't know.
Exactly. Exactly.
It is one of these things where like to steel man the Israeli side, like I imagine dealing with Hamas is difficult in this situation, but like I also feel like I don't know what the correct answer is to any of this. I don't think carpet bombing an entire region is that answer. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't think that's the right one. Crazy. But you know what I mean?
Like, but it's not just our congressman. Likud Party Minister Dudi Amsalam stated in the Israel Public Radio, "We have no interest in hurting people who are innocent. There are almost no innocent people in Gaza. Each of them is either a son or a brother or that he encourages it." Right? I mean, you got Haaretz reported that Israeli soldiers in Gaza's Netzarim corridor described the culture of, quote, indiscriminate killing, end quote. The civilian casualties routinely labeled as terrorists. One soldier quoted Brigadier General Vok saying, "There are no innocents in Gaza. They're all terrorists. These are the things that happen in war. This is the thing that creates the people who, good American boys, go to Vietnam and wipe out a village."
Yeah.
Right? That happens to good people. So it's not saying Jews are inherently this. That would be anti-Semitism, and I'm not an anti-Semite. What I'm saying is people can lose sight of the morality of what they're doing, especially when they're tribaled up, especially when they just see themselves as like this persecuted group under you know, all this pressure from the outside.
Well, and another thing too, is Bibi seems to be losing a lot of favor, not just like externally, but also internally. And I know my understanding is that he's looking to be facing, and a lot of this war going on is very justification for keeping him in power, and also not allowing him to get bogged down with other problems, legal problems that he's facing, which is like embezzlement charges and bribery charges and like all this stuff. So there's also that aspect here is like, you know, the Likud party is one of many parties that exist within the Israeli political structure. And like, I believe they have like 22% of the popularity in Israel. It's like somewhere around that range. I'm not like intimately familiar with all of the different party dynamics, but there's a lot of people in Israel that are also not for the what's going on here.
One of the reasons it seems like
they're gaining more popularity from what
I've seen. One of the reasons why, and of course Murray doesn't mention this because he's a Likud party guy, that the defenses were down at the time was because there was a giant protest going on the other side of the country that they needed security for.
Oh, interesting.
That protest was against Netanyahu about constitutional changes to the judiciary. That's right. So, and I got to do one more of these quotes. A mother of an Israeli sniper, police sniper, appeared on Israeli TV saying, quote, "Finish them off from the air. Children, babies, it's not our concern. Finish them off one by one." The anchor reportedly nodded approvingly.
Oh, good point. Good point.
So, I mean, that is the immoral position. I think being anti-war is the moral position, and that doesn't make me that. I think it makes you a moral coward by refusing to engage with what's happening and instead stepping back and just dealing in platitudes and saying that this is just good guys versus bad guys, terrorists versus good guys. And that's just ridiculous. It's as ridiculous as it was, you know, in Iraq as it is right now.
One final thought before we close off, and it's just cut to like on the counter, like the counter side of this is, Dave Smith was on Tucker. We're not going to play any clips of that, but it is one of those things where, you know, it's crazy that a month after this debate, all of this is still, everybody feels like it's worth, you know, still constantly talking about that debate. And, it really comes down to, and I was like, I agreed with Dave and Tucker, where it's just looking back at this, like this side here, they're not really presenting arguments ever. And I feel like Dave Smith was presenting a lot of arguments that Douglas Murray, who was supposed to be like the champion of the rhetorical side of this, just never shot down. Like, he had his opportunity to put the nail in the coffin on Dave Smith, because that's kind of what it seemed like he was supposed to do in the moment, because it's like, oh, this comedian's getting out of control. He's getting all this audience, and he's saying things that you're not supposed to say about Israel, Gaza, like all this stuff. And then it's just, he came in and there was just no real arguments. And and it's kind of, it even felt that way just from what I've seen of this conversation, is like every time it felt like Jordan almost wanted to go a little bit deeper on something, shift onto the next thing, shift onto the next thing. And it's just like, it just makes them feel, their side feels very shallow from an argumentative standpoint.
Yeah. It's just like debating COVID all over again.
Yeah.
Right. Or debating anything in the last decade when someone from the left, where they're just completely unfamiliar with anything else other than their little echo chamber, and they don't know, and they're not engaged with the overall dialogue.
It's the same way that I feel, and why I've been so interested in the trade war dynamics, is like, I just feel like everybody's being super shallow on the trade war stuff.
Right.
Or just like, I would, you know, you can read and you can look into it a little bit deeper.
And just engage with it. Feels, you can right? have criticism yeah. of it, and there are good criticisms of it all across the board, but engage with the actual things happening.
They're mostly shallow. Is that, yeah. is what it, like, the more I look at them, it's just like, tariffs bad. You know, like, and like, that's right. how it feels like on this. It's just like, Jews good, Hamas bad. Yeah. You're just like, oh, okay, that's kindergarten level. Let's move on. Let's get like fifth grade.
Yeah,
can we
yeah,
do fifth
right.
grade? Like yeah. that's how it feels to me. It was yeah. like
one more note on that too. And this is a thing I saw afterwards when the Tucker thing dropped. Is like he's still talking about it. It must mean that he's insecure. When Murray is going
like
around
lap.
now pretending that it didn't exist.
Yeah,
right. All of his other interviews barely touched on. He kind of talked about Barry Weiss, but everything else afterwards has had nothing to do with it. And you can tell by yeah. who is still talking about it is who won. Right, because if you're still talking about
this
point,
it's a victory lap.
It's a win. If you're pretending it didn't happen with Jordan Peterson, it means it wasn't a win.
Well, and that was the thing with the James Lindsay thing is they're like, we're not going to talk about these people. We're not going to name names. Right? Like there's
even though
a lot of that.
Lindsay
right?
has long lists of names on his Twitter file, yeah. and it's literally always the same people. It's everyone who's critical of neocons.
But anyways, I think we're going to call the episode there. If you liked it, please share it around.
Yeah. Join our Discord.
Join. Yeah. We also do our members only show once a week too, where we usually go into more naughtier topics that we're not supposed to, you know, talk about out loud. Sometimes they go public if we feel like they're not too naughty.
Yeah,
but join our SCIF if you're interested in more content and some of the, maybe the more deeper conspiratorial angles on things and stuff like that too, that we go into. But yeah, thank you for watching.
Thank you guys.
See you next time. And I think we have Joe back next time, too.
Yeah!
So, yeah. Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.